You're sitting in the most uncomfortable chair in one of the most important boardrooms in Hollywood. This studio has produced countless classics, and now here's your chance to make your mark in the industry. The president of the company introduces you as you stand and walk towards the front of the room. The floor is yours. The stage is yours. They lean in as you give the elevator pitch for Son of the Mask. You killed it. They loved it. You sold Son of the Mask, and you got your check. Did it feel good? Well, wait till the movie comes out. You'll question every decision you've ever made. But that's Hollywood, right? It's about the pitch, the sale, the pizzazz, the properties, the marketability, the moneyballing, the shot calling. The party just keeps going as long as we have the rights to Police Academy. But what happens in the end? Well, we're the generation that's experienced it the most. So, let's talk it out. It's Sequelitis, here on Reel of Thieves. Hey everybody, I'm Pete, and this is Reel of Thieves, where I go over all the references, riffs, and history of your favorite stuff. And this week, we're starting a new chapter, a new arc, a new season of our little film history podcast that could. And it's all about Sequelitis. But first, if you're listening to me on wherever you're listening, I'm even on Castro at this point. Can you give this episode or any of the other ones you've loved a rating, maybe a share? That helps the show the most. I have a daily show now that is Monday through Friday over on Beams. It's a little app in the Apple App Store, and the show is called Breaking Character in the Pop Culture category. I break down all your favorite characters from your favorite stuff. I'm going to put a link to my Beams profile in the show notes. If you feel like it, swing by, say hi. You literally can physically say hi to me, and you can ask me to break down one of your favorite characters, and it's two parts. Monday through Friday, so twice a day. Use your voice with Beams. It's in the Apple App Store, Google Play Store. Coming soon. Get on that email list for that. Also, if you missed it last week, go on back to the interview that I had with Chris from Gotham Outsiders. They're fantastic. Please go check that out. It was so fun. All right, and that's it for this week. Computer, prepare the pod for the coming onslaught. We're going to Hulk out on these sequels, Broheem. Did you sigh and cry at the same time? And you, how did you learn how to do both? Wait, did I make a robot that can feel emotions? Eat a dick, Elon! A sequel is, according to Oxford Dictionary, a body of work that continues the story or develops the themes of an earlier one. Now, that last part of the definition might make perfect sense, or it might completely throw you off. If you've never heard the term spiritual sequel, that's when there's essentially a sequel that just goes by the themes, or they're linked by family members, or sometimes recurring characters. Sometimes the links are very strong. Other times they're kind of like paper, and it feels somewhat or completely contrived or superficial, and they just make it up to make money. A ton of the criticism that gets heaved at sequels from the critics and the viewing public, honestly, are based off of bad sequel experiences, not great sequel experiences. Almost all of the people that hate on films for having a long list of sequels or a larger universe of films, which we'll dive into later, have at least one sequel that they point to and go, why couldn't you have done it like this sequel? In fact, What If They Did It Right was a genre video essays on YouTube for a little bit, if you remember. I mean, it can't be the only one left to remember the series on the Star Wars prequels, What If Episode X Was Good, right? Which, in retrospect, is essentially three videos literally shitposting one man's magnum opus, just literally all over his writing, which I tend not to encourage. But also, like, the movies that he talks about would have been pretty type. I mean, a love triangle between the three of them, or at least contrived by Anakin, playing up the idea that Qui-Gon Jinn actually would have been more of a father figure and that Obi-Wan was more of like a semi-jealous stepbrother in a lot of ways. Those would have been really cool. Was he a troll? Was he an artist? Let me know. Twitter, IG, at Reel of Thieves, or email me, reelofthieves@gmail.com. I'm still lonely. But prequels, threequels, spiritual sequels, reboots, they're all plays on the word to help relieve the fatigue of saying sequel over and over and over and over and over again. Imagine an earnings report where every movie is a sequel and you didn't have fun corporate jargon nicknames for the same thing during the meeting. It happened. It happened so goddamn much, they started doing it to make it stop for themselves. And that's really, honestly, the only way you can make a change. And this is really honestly where the idea of a sequel comes from. The money side, the studio heads, the publishing companies for dime store novels, and friggin' Sherlock Holmes books. So many Sherlock Holmes novels. You want to point to anything as the incubator of sequelitis? It kind of starts in the time of serialized pop fiction. See, Sherlock Holmes sold like hotcakes in his starving Arctic town subsidized by a purposefully broken state assistance program. Was that too specific? I'm sorry. So everyone starts begging Sir Arthur Conan Doyle for more. What happens next? Who's the next big bad?
Will they get one over on Holmes?
What if he encountered real paranormal and occult threats?
It's easy to blame comic books, film studios, but it's really greedy book publishers that pushed Doyle. So much that he fucking killed Sherlock Holmes. Then, when everyone said, "No, he's not dead, dance you monkey," he brought Holmes back, and by that point, it's kind of jumping the shark a little bit here and there. It's a simple formula that's easy to replicate. You, as an artist, make something that blows people away. It's original, new, yet fun, and kind of safe, but not too safe because, hey, we haven't seen these people before. We've never been in this particular area before. But for simplicity's sake, we've got some bumpers and seatbelts and safety measures for you as the audience doesn't feel lost. Okay, now we end it on a cliffhanger kind of ending, right? There's another adventure, another call from a new client or a new case. They get a letter from a mysterious villain. Throw a dart on a board of any of these things and pick it. If it lands, we pick it up from there or we do a time jump somewhere between 6 months and 7 years later. Let's face it, it's mostly 2 years. And if that sequel works, then we'll make one more and we'll throw everything we wanted to do at it, like the end of a fireworks display at a theme park. Explosion after explosion of color, sound, and fan service. You leave feeling that that was a journey you took with those characters, years in the making, sometimes decades. And when something like this works, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or a trilogy or whatever, everyone decides it must be science and everything must be this way, but it also becomes more easily produced because of that structure, which makes it cheaper, and then everyone starts ripping off Sherlock Holmes. I mean, to this day, crime dominates not just the publishing industry, but tropes of crime fiction are used in a plethora of other genres and media forms to give them originality, spice them up, or just draw people in with sheer tension. The Batman is a great example of this, right? He's a superhero who's essentially traumatized Sherlock Holmes that instead of getting super into opioids and cocaine like Holmes did, dressed up like a bat and beat the shit out of everyone into a paralyzed lump of broken bone and sinew. I'm so excited, and I want to talk about this film with a special guest later this season, so I'll save it for now. But it's a perfect example of a special kind of sequel. I will consider it technically a sequel, the reboot. It kind of exists in this gray area, right? It's somewhere within the shadows of Gotham. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. Rachel! Okay, I'm done. But the reboot exists in this gray area of, and it's not really a sequel because we're going back to one, right? And this time it's going to be this way in this universe using these things as references, and there's perspective changes and maybe gender bending. They're asking you to go, these are all separate trilogies, so really it's this one movie with these two sequels, and then we go back to one. But what I'm seeing is the first X-Men movie was in 2000, and then there were 10 sequels. Because you have to remember, especially when they bring Hugh Jackman into the mix, they're saying all these movies happened after the first movie. So that means that they didn't technically reboot. They diverted to another timeline, and then a little SpongeBob meme happened and it was 20 years later. And everyone's just getting murked by Sentinels. Quick, send Logan back to the new trilogy? Warner Brothers is doing that right now with all of the DC properties. The Batman can be rebooted and be similar to Nolan again because Nolanverse and Reevesverse are different because also Snyderverse, which they caved into in order to make insert director name here averse a literal subgenre of film at this point. This is a new level of corporate complexity in trying to monetize the idea of auteurism, which I will cover probably in its own season. But also don't tell me who's an auteur. That's the professor's and critic's job. That is not the marketing job. And I don't actually believe you because you didn't come from that world.
Get behind me, Satan!
But is Joker a Batman film? Is it a Batman sequel? I know some people might not be happy about this, but yes, I do believe Joker's technically a Batman film. Because saying Joker doesn't lead to Batman when we see the murder, and it's extremely close to the comics. I mean, they're coming out of an era-accurate adaptation of Zorro and everything. Joker goes to Wayne Manor. It's a prequel. There's no way around it. Could it exist in a universe where Bruce Wayne never becomes Batman? Sure. Would that make sense? Absolutely not. Saying Joker isn't connected to Batman with the way they did it in the film is like saying the prequels of other films don't lead to those events. This is meant to serve as a film definitive origin story, albeit one open to interpretation and on the DC Black label, but it is an origin story nonetheless. And it is for what they would like to eventually use as a model for future Jokers within the Batman universe. Ones that are inspired by Arthur, and implying that, even if that is real Joker or not, and even though he never interacts with the real Batman or not in this kind of rough and tumble way we've come to expect over the years, even though it's just someone that's kind of maybe cosplaying as Arthur, it's still a sequel if you're implying Arthur had anything to do with it. And then that, what? Does that mean that there's like a DC Black Label-averse now? Shit! Like, this doesn't exactly play into the hands, really, in my opinion, of the DC Black Label, because if those films are somewhat influencing other Batman films that end up coming out of the DC Black Label, well, then that makes Black Label canon, and if that's part of the series, do you see how far down this rabbit hole can actually go? Like, I'm the Charlie meme right now. Everything's still a sequel. Another great example is Spider-Man No Way Home. Now, it's technically the end of a trilogy, but it's actually the 8th live-action film because it worked with X-Men, and why not try it here? But it's also a part of the MCU, which many critics argue is being covertly run by Hydra, and that's a joke only people in the MCU will get. So it's the 8th Spider-Man film, but it's also the 27th MCU film? 27th? Now, if you consider the other Spider-Man films to be part of the MCU, that makes it the 35th Marvel film. That's a number I want us to reflect on for a minute. In 3 more films in this series, if you discount the previous Sony films, we'll be at 30. By definition of what I've talked about, that makes it the 29th Marvel sequel. In my childhood, we made fun of situations like this occurring in real life in a way that we implied would never happen. Like, the running joke in shows like The Simpsons was that Police Academy was going to have all these sequels and it was going to feel like there were 27 Police Academy movies. There were only 7. There's 35 Marvel films, and that doesn't count X-Men or Fantastic Four or Blade. I don't even know what's happening anymore. And at that point, what are we even saying that's new and justified on this front at all? Right now, I'm not even sure. It seems to kind of just be the phase of fan service and nostalgia and this kind of third act fireworks display, but for all of these films happening at once. It's all these avant-garde characters dedicated fans wanted and big bads and storylines that are just around the corner from other franchises. But instead of it being one movie, it's going to be 15. I think they're going to plan to stop eventually, but even so, that doesn't stop them from rebooting or starting again with a newer, more modern storyline. But again, this is also kind of how it's always been. And this is the system that everyone's kind of bought into their entire lives. It's the business model for the majority of written art forms. And does this stifle originality? Of course it does. It kind of destroys it. But that's where indie films really succeed. Rarely do you have an indie franchise, but when you do, they tend to be quite interesting. I think there's really only 4 I'd ever consider being an indie franchise. That would be Sam Raimi's Evil Dead trilogy, Robert Rodriguez's El Mariachi trilogy, Kevin Smith's whole Jay and Silent Bob universe thing, because they were spawned from independent films and kind of stayed fairly indie throughout the whole development. And I guess you could call it the True Romance trilogy? from Quentin Tarantino. Both Clerks and El Mariachi, coincidentally, played at Sundance Film Festival 1994 and 92, respectively, with El Mariachi playing alongside Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. Also, coincidentally, both those films lost to a documentary about grandfather clocks. So I think a lot of people really regret a lot of the decisions and how much they drank during that weekend. But they all ended up making it, so good for them. Although, I don't actually know what happened to the clock guy. I hope he's okay. Oh, that's good. I'm glad. No, I don't need to, you don't need to actually let me know. I don't actually care. But now I'd like to talk about Smith, Rodriguez, and Tarantino for a minute because their sequel ideas are down different tracks, but Smith and Tarantino kind of go down this spiritual route, while Rodriguez goes down the Raimi-styled sequel reboot route. And I find both kind of more interesting ways to do sequels that doesn't feel kind of contrived, right? So what I'm going to kind of do is separate Raimi and Rodriguez with Smith and Tarantino for a minute, because their sequel ideas are kind of self-contained and cellular. So let's talk about Robert Rodriguez. El Mariachi was made for around $7,000 US back in 1993 Mexico, the equivalent of maybe $15,000 or $20,000 today in the same areas, and went on to make $2 million after being picked up by Sundance and given a theatrical release, the equivalent of about $4 or $5 million today. It's a Mexican spaghetti western, which is the modern cultural genre mashup of making a Norwegian South Korean horror film. It's about a mariachi, down and out on his luck, who's mistakenly taking a guitar case full of guns instead of the one with the guitar, and essentially becomes Django. This case of mistaken identity causes our reluctant anti-hero to become El Mariachi, an unnamed hitman out for revenge for the death of his love in the first movie by the time we get to Desperado. This not only served as a sequel to El Mariachi, but kind of a soft reboot, as they recast El Mariachi with Antonio Banderas. In a nod to Sergio Leone films because he would reuse actors in different roles, the original actor, Carlos Guerra, was reused as one of the mariachi gang members that El Mariachi forms in between the first and second film, which is a trope that we will use throughout this trilogy, the idea that there are adventures in between our movies and we're only getting pieces of the story. They go over the first film pretty quickly in the beginning in a nightmare sequence before switching over to our new storyline. And Tarantino said that El Mariachi for Robert Rodriguez was kind of a fistful of dollars situation and that Desperado was for a few dollars more. But I'd say that Desperado serves as both films one and two, and arguably Desperado is kind of the better film. I feel like this was the movie Rodriguez kind of wanted to make, kind of like how Sam Raimi had money and was able to do Evil Dead 2. But like both those filmmakers, they couldn't make the film they wanted to make initially due to budget constraints. And the return for Desperado, while good, wasn't as good as the first, because how the hell can you beat a $7,000 budget with a $2 million return? So the third in the trilogy kind of sat untouched for a number of years until Rodriguez could once again fund the vision of the film for himself, but he wanted to do the big budget fireworks thing. He did, however, fall into a bit of a fantasy-esque trap, not unlike Sam Raimi did in the Evil Dead trilogy with Army of Darkness. Now, with Evil Dead 2, like I said, it's effectively rewritten the story of the first film in the beginning, and it fits a newer, higher-budget narrative, and it leaned more into the genre tropes it was drawing from, and honestly, the Three Stooges. Most of the humor from the Evil Dead trilogy are sight gags and physical comedy tricks that the three would do, but they were all inside Ash. By the time we get to Army of Darkness and the origins of the Necronomicon, it feels very out of place from the rest of the trilogy, to be honest. And unfortunately, that's what happens in Once Upon a Time in Mexico. We lean very heavily into the good, bad, and the ugly motif, forcing the archetypes into the story, and while awesome for genre fans, it felt too fantastical. They reference an entire other story, kind of like the first film, but it feels more like a missing entry in a foreign film series that's lost to time, which is something Rodriguez purposefully did. But that story was unfortunately the exact story I wanted to see. And those flashbacks are some of the best parts of the film and felt more in line with the rest of the series and a much smoother transition. Now, Tarantino did do a trilogy of sorts, and technically Reservoir Dogs is the second entry. True Romance, Reservoir Dogs, and Pulp Fiction form their own. All three share similar themes of pulp crime fiction, typically associated with classic film noir movies like The Harder They Fall and The Maltese Falcon, and more modern takes like Chinatown or Brick. But the period in which Chinatown was made was the American New Wave, which was influenced by the French New Wave, which is where Tarantino really drew a lot of his early work from, especially stylistically. French New Wave films were heavily influenced by film noir, especially since the critics turned filmmakers that created the movement cited Alfred Hitchcock and other B-movie directors as having distinct characteristic styles that served as the driving creative force behind all phases of production. those auteur directors were the real artists, and Tarantino is trying very hard to be one of those filmmakers known as an auteur. So when you name your production company after a Godard film, a band apart, and everyone is in this hip 60s aesthetic, well, you're being kind of on the nose with your intentions, right? And the people that needed to see that at the time saw it. And arguably, Tarantino is one of the better examples of modern auteurs that we have today. Denis Villeneuve, who I've gushed about on this show during our Dune episode, is also another example. He draws from this period, but not necessarily from the aesthetic as much as he pulls from the intention of the filmmakers behind the aesthetic, so it comes across a little differently. Tarantino does this trilogy of sorts in an interesting avant-garde French New Wave spiritual sequel kind of way, by making small, almost inconsequential connections between characters and timelines. In True Romance, one of the characters we follow is named Alabama. That's Clarence's love interest. In the original script, Clarence dies, so Alabama continues on a life of crime. So if that happens, she ends up being a partner with Mr. White prior to the heist, and Mr. Orange, played by Michael Madsen, is one of the only fully named characters in the script, Victor Vega. He's the older brother of Vincent Vega, John Travolta's character in Pulp Fiction. Both Vincent and Jules wear the same suits the gang wears in Reservoir Dogs as well. Kevin Smith's take on connecting movies, though, is using the recurring characters of Jay and Silent Bob, but also with the in-universe brands the filmmaker does, kind of like Tarantino. Brands of cereal, fast food joints, cigarettes, all that stuff. They're all shared in both the Band Apart films and View Askew films. I'm not saying they both share the same things. I'm saying the films share the same brands. I'm not trying to be confusing. My wife says I talk like Jeff Goldblum. So these latter two directors are doing, you could argue, spiritual sequels to their films. You could also argue they're building a shared universe, which has been popular in pulp novels and comics and serialized fiction since forever, and allows you to move laterally in a world where most stories are fairly linear and only follow one person. But to the Joker reference earlier, there are actually two films that connect each other spiritually in the definitive sense, right? And these are two films that Joker's referencing and kind of trying to be a third-ish entry into, right? It's Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy. Now, first viewing, with no background, it could be easily overlooked that these films are connected. But both are dealing with themes of isolation. The insanity that that isolation brings, and the difficulty to discern what's real after a particular point. It's a theme Scorsese plays with very well, particularly with De Niro. In Taxi Driver, we follow Travis Bickle, a not-so-closet racist who just came back from Vietnam and now can't seem to sleep, but instead of going to the doctor, he decides to just keep working all night and stay up forever. Travis also has zero connection to reality at this point. He goes to porno theaters because normal people go to the movies, acting like they're regular movies. He creates quick draw devices and threatens an imaginary self in the mirror, acting out their murder. He also has a fascination with being this avenging angel, punisher kind of character, and the film feels very timely with both this aspect and this racism that he expresses. In the end, he acts out the fantasy, finding a young girl, being used as a prostitute, and killing the clients, pimp, and gang members all in front of her. He lies bleeding. And it's left up to interpretation whether or not the ending is a fantasy that he's having in his head, or if it's actually real. In The King of Comedy, we follow Rupert Pumpkin, who's obsessed with Jerry Langford, played here by Jerry Lewis in his final film for 20th Century Fox. Rupert is an aspiring stand-up comedian who wants to get his big break on Jerry's show, but Rupert is also a really shitty comedian. He is, however, completely delusional and obsessed with fame, making him come across like a singer rejected at an American Idol audition. So he does what some might fantasize about, a power fantasy sense again, except instead of becoming the Punisher, he kind of becomes a kidnapper with another stalker. By this point, Rupert thinks he's kind of friends with Jerry, and sometimes thinks he's a co-worker. Masha, the other stalker, thinks Jerry and her should be married and has this imaginary relationship with them. Rupert and Masha actually pull it off, and the FBI allows Rupert's ransom to be paid for the safe return of Jerry. That ransom? A set on this show. During his set, Rupert apparently kills. He even admits his plan, and it seems like everyone thinks it's a joke. The FBI talks about how unfunny it was after, and since Rupert's lens is pretty damaged for us to look through, that's probably what actually happened. He ends his set with, it's better to be king for a night than a schmuck for a lifetime, which in hindsight is really bad advice. Later, after serving his sentence, there's a memoir about his crime, and he says they're weighing options for films before being introduced to a live studio audience for an interview. But he's introduced 7 times in a row, which never happens. So once again, it's open to interpretation. What actually happens at the end, and what's delusional? Unfortunately for the King of Comedy, it's actually quite hard to tell what's real and what's not, but this is something Joker plays into fairly well. The difference with Joker is that they literally take both films and go, what if Travis and Rupert were the same person? What results is exactly the film we get. And I do think that's the concept that they ran with. If it's not, they did a very good job making it appear that way. If you've watched all 3 in a row, you'd see what Joker's trying to say to those 2 movies. And this is what it kind of means for films to be having a conversation with each other. Now, what if we bent the genres inside those sequels instead? Can you do this? Yes, you can. You can lean in to particular elements of a franchise for each entry and get different results with similar characters and storylines and themes. And if it's done right, a good sequel can be better than the first film, better than any of the others, or completely revitalize an entire dead franchise. And we're going to go there.
Because it's about family.
The Fast and the Furious franchise, which rolls off the tongue way better than I thought it ever would, is a great example. I mean, after Too Fast, Too Furious, there was a significant drop in interest. Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift was a borderline straight-to-DVD film. I mean, this was a completely dead franchise. It bombed hard in the US, even with a cameo from Vin. But at that point, no one actually cared about Vin Diesel either. His career was kind of dead too, stuck in this John Travolta-esque trap of film despair that occasionally he gets stuck in. You saw the last movie Travolta did with Fred Durst directing, right? The Fan or whatever? It's kind of like if The King of Comedy was directed by the Farley brothers, but they just didn't read the script. So who directed Tokyo Drift? Justin Lin, the very man who would go on to revitalize the franchise completely. Between this and Annapolis, he's kind of just losing money for studios, but Lin cut his teeth on indie dramas like Better Luck Tomorrow and highlighting the Asian American experience. And despite it not doing well here in Japan, Tokyo Drift killed. This was around the time studios started realizing that they didn't actually just need US numbers anymore. And they saw where the wind was going to take them on this one, and they smell money like blood in the water. So they have him come back again and do the 4th movie, Fast and Furious, which brought characters from all 3 films together in an Ocean's 11 style globe-trotting romp. The result was box office glory, baby. Over 350 million worldwide. Over 30 million opening night. It set records. Fast and Furious set records. Where they are now in the series is legitimately ridiculous. Also, the feud between The Rock and Vin Diesel, and Diesel actually comparing himself to Frank Cassavetti, and de facto comparing the filming style of the Fast and Furious franchise to be that of a French New Wave filmmaker is an interpretation of events that unfolded. That's my most political answer, right, computer?
Yeah, I fucking nailed it!
There are 2 sequels in my mind that are peak sequels, and they represent everything about doing it, and doing it, and doing it well. They are both directed by action film auteur and Jacques Cousteau cosplay connoisseur James Cameron. They are T2 Judgment Day and motherfucking Aliens. Both of these are getting in-depth episodes, guaranteed, as will other films I mentioned and didn't mention, and there's a lot of sequels to talk about, so this arc is probably going to be longer than adaptation, but I think you're here for the ride. So, T2 Judgment Day takes place many years later after John Connor is a teenager and he's caught up in the foster care system. His mother, Sarah Connor, is a convicted terrorist who is plagued by paranoid delusions of a future nuclear war fought by humanity in Cyberdyne Systems, who creates Skynet, which creates the Terminators. She knows this because a man traveled back in time, sent by her son, banged that guy's mom, found out he was his best friend's dad, then died saving Sarah and John, and also probably because, well, would you want to live when you found that out? It's like Oedipus. The Terminator is definitively a slasher film with a sci-fi edge, but T2 is firmly in the sci-fi action with horror elements category, leaning more and more into war film aspects and the lore. There's also a bit of a twist. In T1, we have 1 Terminator, but this is a sequel. So to make it bigger, we have to have 2. But there has to be a twist. So this whole time we see Arnold in the beginning, and we think he's the hunter-killer robot, right? Because that's what we've been conditioned in T1. We think as an audience, there are two Terminators hunting Sarah and John, and that they must team up at some point to try to kill both of them. When Arnold saves Sarah Connor in the hospital, that was the biggest WTF moment of the early 1990s. Arnold is the hero in this one. He was the bad guy last time. And by exploring this interesting change, all of them look like him, yet each one could be an individual, that something is programmed to kill, but if it's taught empathy and compassion in non-lethal forms of takedowns, that it could kind of just protect the Connors, maybe he could be good. In the end, he sacrifices himself for these people, the way Reese did in the first film, which is a showing of how human he's become, because he is willing to sacrifice himself out of love. It's a full circle. And it's one where you really only need two, and that's it. Please don't go past two. Please, look at me. No, look at me. Don't go past Terminator 2. Don't you dare. Don't watch Rise of the Machines, please, for the love of God. Aliens is also in this genre-bending camp, and we also lean more into sci-fi action and these war elements of the film because Cameron was going through a phase. And we're still using the horror elements, don't worry, because phase. This is still a scary movie. T2, in some cases, is still definitely a horror film. Do you remember the kitchen scene where he pulls his skin off? I do. Vividly. This is what made these entries really unique, because we're really kind of exposing people to a lot of body horror. You weren't really getting that in mainstream movies. That's what kind of makes these entries so unique. I mean, we're giving a lot of body horror elements in action movies, and there's sci-fi, and there's war stuff, and it feels like these kind of movies could be talking about other things. In Aliens, it's another time jump, but even more severe. It's 40-something years later. Ripley's daughter's older than her now. It's the McConaughey moment. In Aliens, it's another time jump, but it's even more severe. It's 40-something years later. Ripley's daughter's older than her now. I mean, literally the McConaughey moment. And the company has now settled on LV-426, saying there were no life forms there, she's crazy, and they're using it as a mining colony. What they didn't tell people was that they were mining aliens from their bodies. But all those people got paid in Cardano, so the future looks really bright. Ripley goes back with a group of space marines after they lose contact, and Ripley is the only one who's ever been to the planet's surface and returned. What results is Space Vietnam. In both movies, the female leads take a very masculine archetype and play it like a man. Ripley was literally written as a man and was cast as a man until Ridley Scott decided to cast Sigourney Weaver. In T2 and in Aliens, we're going in the badass action star category. Sarah Connor regularly works out in her cell and strips firearms in the desert while dressing more like a mercenary than an 80s party girl that we met in T1. She's willing, in some cases, to go further than the Terminator wants to go. Both add to the world of the franchises they belong to in expected ways that were bigger and better, that the suits wanted, but also the public kind of wants. But it offers surprises people didn't see coming in major Hollywood titles like this. So much so that it's often expected to have some sort of twist like this in later iterations after these films come out. Doctor Strange 2 is probably going to lean more into the horror elements of Strange and make it more psychedelic because everyone talks about those kinds of scenes from the first film. Those were the most effective, and that's basically the majority. But I would actually like everyone to go back to when Strange was in his apartment and having the argument with his girlfriend before his major journey. The acting in that scene is so powerful, and it shows how far Strange has to go to get where he needs to be to become the Sorcerer Supreme. But it's also full of crazy alternate what-if castings that people don't usually get in films. There are thousands of deepfake videos putting other actors and faces and voices in roles of films they had no business being in because they weren't born yet. Now we're just like, hey, what if Iron Man was like this and played by so-and-so? Or let's bring the original X-Men cast back again because we don't believe in our casting director's ability to affect change. No Way Home has showed us how to do this to great effect, so much so that it's the most successful film ever made. It's literally something we haven't seen before in film happening in a comic book movie. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. It's not like we haven't had this happen in TV. Just look to the Arrowverse at this, or DC animated series about alternate Justice Leagues, right? We just haven't had it at this level before, and haven't had it work so well, basically right out of the gate. But we're about to be inundated now. And this shit is gonna get real. So just buckle in and get ready for the NFTs, get ready for the SNL skits, get ready for all the crazy stuff, because you're gonna feel it, and it's gonna feel like sensory overload. Sequels are, by and large, a part of the industry, because they've worked for years. And as much as we get pissed about not having enough originality, we also would be upset if every year it felt like they were just throwing darts at a board and hoping it all worked out. We did do that. It was the American New Wave. And I appreciate everything that the New Wave brought, both French and American New Waves. A lot. It did a lot to advance the art form of film, and changed a lot of the ways that we look at film and what messages could be in film. And we do need dangerous, unique, crazy filmmakers, and we need the indie scene to make it happen. The studios like A24 have done amazing work in this realm and have created a literal aesthetic around their studio. That's an incredible feat. You know an A24 film when you see the trailer, you feel it. And those filmmakers come into the pop world and bring an originality and a passion that can change pop culture for decades. They can literally change the course of a major franchise and have everyone go, see, why can't more movies be like that one? It's an incredible feeling, and it's a skill to write a sequel. And it's a skill that we're going to try to hone as we go through this block. That's right, we're going to be trying to make better sequels as we write this time. And while it seems like a Herculean task, I actually can't wait. And I hope that you join me this time and do your homework on this journey here on Reel of Thieves.